Dylan Blaha is challenging incumbent Democratic Congresswoman Nikki Budzinski from the left. The Illinois National Guard member from Urbana will have an uphill battle to unseat the second-term U.S. representative. But on this episode of Politically Speaking, we chat with Blaha about how he'd govern differently and what it will take to win the primary in a district that represents much of the Metro East. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking Podcast, an in-depth examination of Missouri and Illinois politics.
The instant we got to Illinois, we joined the Green Party. This was 2000.
So I've tried to push for those that I think are honest and really care about the future of the city.
You know, this wasn't a path that I thought I would choose in 2012 when I was able to win the closest Republican victory in the nation.
If it's something that will help Southern Illinois, I'll work with them on it. If there's something he's doing wrong, then you got to fight him on it.
I believe very strongly in the Second Amendment. I believe less government is better, and I believe local control is better.
I choose to fight for working families and for union members.
Welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm St. Louis Public Radio's Metro East reporter, Will Bauer. Joining us for the first time on the show is a Democratic candidate in Illinois' 13th Congressional District.
Hi, my name is Dylan Blaha. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks, Dylan. Thanks for being here. And somehow I was mentioning this to Congresswoman Budzinski. We're already less than a month away from early voting. Mm-hmm. It feels like we're constantly in election. And I'd imagine it feels that much crazier for you who's actually running for the office.
Yeah, no, it's insane. Yeah, election day is March 17th, but like you said, early voting starts on February 5th, which is very, very soon.
Yeah. Okay. So maybe before we get into all the nitty-gritty of the issues and whatnot, there's probably some people that, if they're early voting, they may say, I don't know that name. So what should voters know about you, Dylan?
Yeah, I'm a pro-peace U.S. Army veteran. I've served for over 13 years in the Illinois Army National Guard, including 5 years on active duty in places like Afghanistan and Germany. And then I was also a cancer research scientist for 4 years at the University of Illinois. But ultimately, I'm running to get big money out of politics and just fight for the working class.
I wanted to ask you about how you would define yourself. To be honest, my editor and I yesterday were debating progressive, democratic, socialist. Does it matter? And if they're different, how are they different? I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm usually not one for labels. I mean, at the end of the day, I just say that most of our policies are just focused on affordability and fighting for human and civil rights. So I mean, I am a member of the DSA. I always joke about the word progressive because even Andrew Cuomo calls himself a progressive. But, I just like to say I'm not a fan of labels. I just, you know, have my policies speak for themselves.
Is it safe to say, though, that you would consider yourself to be maybe a little more to the left or more progressive than the congresswoman?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Well, and that kind of leads me into my next question, which is why run in the 13th Congressional District, just given that it, in theory, could be a district that is competitive for Republicans in a particular year? Do you feel like you're maybe too progressive for a somewhat moderate district?
I will say that right now, a lot of it just depends on your policies. Like Nikki won 59-41 in the last election, and I think with the anti-Trump sentiment, it could push it even a little bit more blue. But right now, I always just say, what's more bipartisan than affordability and fighting for the working class, which makes up the base of both parties?
What do you think it would take to unseat her in a primary?
I think a lot of it is just getting the word out. I always tell people I can't win with name recognition, right? I'm never going to beat her with money. So I need to beat her by educating people on what we both stand for, what she's voted for, and then hopefully they'll pick me.
I think in a lot of ways, this primary challenge probably exemplifies a divide in the Democratic Party that's happening not just here, but everywhere. And there's a lot of introspection happening after the 2024 election. And I think generically speaking, simply put, there's a belief that Democrats haven't been effective enough playing offense against the Trump administration. There's a lot of dialogue after Zohran Mamdani won the New York City mayoral election and maybe even locally after Senator Dick Durbin and others broke legislative stalemates and voted with Republicans, for example. Maybe do you believe that this current Democratic Party has failed their constituents with how they've led over the last year?
I do. I think that they've unfortunately given in to Republican rhetoric too much. And I think we see it with things like immigration. Look at where we were a year ago. There was polling that there was a lot of people in favor of stronger immigration policies. But at the same point, those same polls shows that there was also a demand for or an interest in increased amnesty for immigrants. But now, polling for immigration a year later, seeing Trump's Gestapo known as ICE and everything that they're doing, we see how much people are in favor of just increasing pathways for immigration. And that's something that that's one of the main reasons why I'm running against Nikki, is because of her horrible growth votes on immigration and her vote for the Laken Riley Act.
In terms of this race, maybe beyond immigration, where do you think the congresswoman has gone wrong, and how would you govern differently if you were elected?
Yeah, I usually say in this answer that I'm not just running against Nikki. I'm running against the Democratic Party, the amount of Democratic congressmen and women and senators who take corporate money, who take money from foreign interest groups like AIPAC, and seemingly vote against their constituents again and again. And 6 in 10 Americans, Republican or Democrat, believe in Medicare for all. So why is it not more popular within the Democratic Party? And I always go back to money in politics, the fact that they take money from health insurance companies, pharmaceutical companies who have an interest to not have Medicare for all.
Are you a fan of getting rid of corporate PAC money in elections and dark money and
yep.
whatnot? Okay.
No, absolutely. I believe that we need public funding in elections, and that's hopefully where we will get to. I think there's so many people who realize that that is a big fault right now. And it's not just, I mean, the billionaires are all behind Trump right now because he's in power. But what we can't do is go back to not taxing billionaires and just giving into private interests.
Congressional stock trading. How do you feel about that?
We need to ban it. Yeah, that's an easy one. I think, you know, it's right now, what, like $174,000 a year for a House representative. Like, that's more money than I would have ever made in my life. And no, I don't need to trade stocks.
Maybe looking back to the election in 2024, where do you think Democrats went wrong?
I do think that they didn't give and part of this is unfortunately the fact that Biden pulled out so late. Harris only had 107 days until the election. But ultimately, I think it was that they didn't separate themselves from Biden. And a lot of people didn't feel like America was affordable anymore. And so when you say, oh, the GDP is actually up, America's economy is doing great, that doesn't ring true when our pockets get lighter and lighter every day. But then there are certain things like, I mean, the genocide in Gaza. And that's something that, unfortunately, I feel like both parties, foreign policy-wise, are uniparty when it comes to foreign policy. They vote for war. We see even with Venezuela, what do a lot of the corporate Democrats say? They say, oh, you didn't follow the rules. You didn't go through us to vote for it first. They didn't say that they didn't want war with Venezuela. Yeah.
I wanted to also ask you about two votes that Senator Dick Durbin, who's retiring, has taken in the last year that I think really upset a lot of Democrats. The first one was to pass a spending bill in March to fund the government. And the second one was to vote with Republicans along 7 others in the Democratic caucus to end the government shutdown. That was this fall. Do you think he was wrong in those two votes?
I do. I think that for once, the Democratic Party was actually on message that, hey, the Republicans are going to cut your ACA benefits and health insurance premiums are going to skyrocket, as they now are. But I also think in this case, I think it was a broader Democratic Party position, and he was just a scapegoat because everyone that voted for it does not have an upcoming election in 2026. So I do think that Durbin was just a fall guy in this case, but it's something that that's why I would never, you know, vote for Schumer. I would not vote for Jeffries because they are not taking our party in the right direction.
There was also a lot of dialogue in this country after Zoran Mamdani won the mayoral election, and I think There's a lot of questions about what does that say, if anything, about the broader trends of Democratic politics. What do you make of his win?
I think it's a great step, but unfortunately, as Zoran says, it's all about how he delivers. And so these next couple of years are crucial. He is already moving very quickly. And I always say we need to move quickly, as quick as Donald Trump's regime is moving, but in the way of good. You know, we do need to start quickly reforming taxes, giving Medicare for all, ending student debt. We need to be aggressive. Otherwise, we're just gonna lose again in 2030 and 2032.
And maybe the pushback to reading too much into Zoran's win would be New York City is maybe arguably one of the most liberal bastions in this country. So, yes, you would expect them to elect someone who's pretty progressive, but that may not be representative of the rest of the country, or at least the rest of the Democratic Party in maybe the Midwest. How do you kind of grapple with that?
What I usually say is that it's all about messaging and what policies you prioritize. So the things that he said as far as free school lunch, fast free buses, like these are things that are popular everywhere, but in our district, it'll have a different shape. And so with us, I think right now the biggest ones are Medicare for all, building affordable housing, and investing in infrastructure, especially in places like Springfield and Metro East, where there's just been so much underinvestment over the years and it hasn't been allocated evenly at all.
A little bit of a transition. I wanted to ask you about, you made some headlines last fall when you said that you would refuse National Guard orders. At the time, the White House had ordered National Guard troops, including the Illinois National Guard, to deploy to Chicago, amid an immigration crackdown. Maybe first, did you face any formal retribution for saying that?
So I am still under, well, I guess the investigation's concluded now, but they've said there's 9 things that I might be charged with. But ultimately, a lot of it's just they're trying to find me guilty of anything because they're mad that I made those videos. So I had made videos before when Trump deployed the National Guard to Los Angeles, and I spoke out against that. But they didn't get enough views that it was all of a sudden when these 2 videos got millions and millions of views, they felt the need to punish me. So they revoked my security clearance, but everything else is just kind of in limbo right now.
So are you not going to the, what is it, monthly, forgive me, I should know, annual, or not annual, monthly National Guard? Mm-hmm. What would you call those?
Like our monthly drill weekends.
There you go. Yeah.
I am still going to those, and everyone just awkwardly doesn't bring it up. But it is crazy right now because we're going to drill and training, and nobody's talking about the fact that Trump just illegally bombed Venezuela and kidnapped their leader on January 3rd. So it's tough right now. I think, unfortunately, like, the U.S. military has a culture of fear, and so it's a way to get people to not speak out. A lot of people think, oh, I don't want to lose my benefits. I don't want to lose my retirement. I'll just sit here and say nothing.
Why defy those orders if they were to come down?
Well, one, I mean, they're illegal. And luckily, the Supreme Court has backed me up on that. But ultimately, I didn't raise my right hand to go against the American people. I raised my right hand to defend the Constitution and protect the American people.
I want to transition into some other issues. You mentioned affordability. Mm-hmm. How do you believe that Congress should make everyday life more affordable for Americans?
I think we need to go back to the New Deal time of America, and we need to make sure that everyone is paying their fair share. And so some people will jump out and defend billionaires and corporations, but the fact of the matter is that they are not getting taxed equally, and they have so many more lawyers to find these loopholes. But ultimately, we look at a lot of these corporations, and there are corporations year by year that pay nothing in taxes because it's just small loopholes. Like, they have their business address in another country, but clearly they're doing business in America. Those are the things that we need to stop. And there's tons of misinformation when it comes to things like Medicare for All. You've probably heard the misinformation about, oh, Canada's system is so slow. I mean, when I was in Germany, I went to the ER one day and I paid $12 and I had x-rays and labs done that day. And that can be the future of America. We just all need to get there together.
And the challenge will be finding a way to pay for it. And income tax, it sounds like, for wealthier Americans would be an avenue, and also closing the loopholes for corporations and corporate tax.
Yeah, that, and I am also a fan of cutting the defense budget by at least $100 billion. I mean, that was with the current budget. Obviously, Trump wants to make it $1.5 trillion. We can also defund ICE, which would definitely help as well.
So with the defense budget, I'm imagining there's probably people out there saying, maybe I like the idea of that, but also we live in a time where Russia is actively advancing on Ukraine and potentially other NATO countries. China is maybe flirting with something, militarily speaking, with Taiwan. They maybe appreciate that sentiment, but why cut defense spending when those 2 things are happening elsewhere in the world?
No, that's true. I do think that it is important for all NATO countries to pay into NATO if we're going to uphold that treaty. And ultimately, I think a lot of it is there's so much fraud, waste, and abuse in the military. when it comes to things like companies that get contracts and don't fulfill them. And right now, we just see that it's another excuse that the government can line the pockets of Elon Musk, SpaceX, or Jeff Bezos. And those are the things. Like, only 22% of our current government spending goes to personnel. And so things like personnel, training, equipment upkeep, like those are necessary spending things. But there's a lot of ways that we can cut costs and still have an effective military. But we also need to get out of the idea that we can be Team America World Police. It's just, it's something that we cannot sustain this in the future. And we do need to invest more in our American communities.
Speaking of that, what do you make of the Trump administration's decision to capture Nicolas Maduro?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's horrible. And while it is unfortunate that a lot of other countries around the world live in authoritarian regimes, and it is something that it's difficult to see it. It's difficult to see it on the news. We see the protests in Iran, and there were people that, you know, were celebrating in the streets of Venezuela. However, it was not with good intentions. The U.S. is not about spreading democracy around the world. It's about their own self-interest. And unfortunately, we saw that with Iraq in 2003. You know, we've seen everything that we did in Afghanistan. I mean, I was there from 19 to 20, and I was really wondering why we were there in the first place, because it felt like things had really fallen for a long time. And we knew that the second we left, the Taliban would take over. But yeah, with Venezuela, it is unfortunately all about oil. And, you know, I know a lot of people have gone on and said, oh, Maduro is a dictator, but that does just play into the right-wing framing that this was okay. And, yeah, he wasn't great, but it's important to recognize that regardless of how Maduro was, it is illegal for the U.S. to do that.
If you're elected to Congress, how should Congress enforce checks and balances on President Trump's actions, whether it's Venezuela, maybe something possibly with Greenland, or the one that he's reportedly considering is striking Iran after the violent crackdown on protesters?
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously trying to cut funding. I really just think we should go right to impeachment. Unfortunately, right now, he has taken away Congress's power of the purse. And so we've even seen money that's been allocated has then been canceled later. And it's crippling. I mean, I appreciate that everything that you guys do here. And I mean, public funding for broadcasting is something that is vital to our society. I always say journalism and education are the bedrocks of America. And if we take those away, we will just continue spiraling further into authoritarianism.
You mentioned immigration earlier. Data does show that border crossings have dropped quite dramatically since President Trump took office. Do you think that Democrats made a mistake in their efforts around the U.S.-Mexico border during the Biden administration?
I think, unfortunately, I mean, we've seen it with Barack Obama, with Joe Biden. Like, we have been pretty uniparty on immigration for a long time. And what we haven't seen, though, is ways to improve the current system. So I believe that that's ultimately what we need. We need to increase pathways to citizenship. I mean, undocumented immigrants already pay taxes. Now we need to make sure that they're set up for success. And so ultimately, I believe the only way forward is a system where they self-report. We can help set them up with work. They start paying taxes and they get on a path, whether that's maybe 10 years, 7 years, 5 years, whatever, path to citizenship.
Do you think, though, there's been too many illegal crossings at the southern border?
Ultimately, I don't know. I mean, as far as I really don't like to play into right-wing framing and all that. I think ultimately part of the reason why it's so hard to immigrate legally in this country is because it's easier for billionaires and corporations to exploit cheap labor. And so if we create more pathways to citizenship, then we have to pay them all a living wage. And not that we pay that to Americans right now anyway. But no, I mean, I think it's something that we haven't handled well for a long time. And we do need to handle it better. And so I always do say, hey, there is a problem with immigration in America. But the problem is the policy, the way that there's no good way to immigrate right now.
And you've mentioned ICE deployments and crackdowns and whatnot. I believe you used the term Gestapo to describe them. What do you make of, just generally speaking, how this administration has used immigration and customs enforcement?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, ICE has been around for, what, like 22 years, and it was an outgrowth of the war on terror, and unfortunately, they've really weaponized ICE not only to just go after black and brown communities, but really just to go after dissenters in general. I mean, we see what happened to Renee Nicole Good and all the other people that have either died in ICE custody or been abused by them in some way. And ultimately, it can't go on this way. But also, it is important to note that, like, ICE has been doing this to a smaller degree for a very long time. And now it's just, like, a lot of things that Trump's doing didn't just start in his current administration. They've been going on for a long time. He's just way more explicit about it. And I think that's finally opening America's eyes to what's really going on.
Congresswoman Robin Kelly, who's running for the now soon-to-be-vacant Senate seat to replace Senator Durbin, has announced that she will. She has plans to impeach Kristi Noem, the Secretary for Homeland Security. If you were in Congress right now, would you support that effort?
Definitely. Yeah, I think. I mean, I'm in the abolish ICE, investigate ICE, and prosecute ICE train. I think right now, as DHS has said, that their agents operate with full immunity, and that is completely not true. And we need to hold them accountable for, you know, the rule of law and make sure that they are following the right laws.
I did want to also ask you about some local issues that, if elected, you'd likely be tracking in this area. So the first is the steel mill in Granite City, Granite City Works. Their parent company recently announced that they would restart one of the two blast furnaces at some point this spring. It was seen by the steelworkers as a short-term win and an opportunity to prove themselves under the new Japanese leadership. How would your office advocate for the steel mill in Granite City?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that we've seen throughout the district that we need better jobs with better wages in this community. And so I think that's a great way to start, but we do need long-term solutions, right? And so one thing that we've kind of seen, Nikki is a big proponent for the AI data center that they proposed near Springfield. And a lot of the unions are as well, because it'll create decent jobs for a short amount of time. It just shows the glaring need for better jobs, because so many businesses have moved out of this district. But I believe that we cannot create jobs at the cost of our environment, of our education, and so ultimately, like, that's why I've been very anti-AI in its current form, because people are losing jobs, it's destroying the environment, and we don't have any checks and balances, any regulations on it. Ultimately, I think the steel mill and fighting for them will be important, but so will just getting more jobs into the district. I'm also a proponent of the PRO Act in order to enable everyone in America to unionize. And I'm in favor of overturning the Taft-Hartley Act to really increase union collective bargaining rights throughout the country.
The other local issue I wanted to ask you about is Cahokia Heights. Mm-hmm. This is a part of the Metro East that's seen loads of flooding and sewer problems for a long, long time. There's been some progress in the last 5 years or so, but it's been slow, and residents there are always saying we need them to happen faster. Mm-hmm. Do you think there's anything that should be done differently to speed up those massive infrastructure projects?
Yeah, I've been aware of the Cahokia Heights situation for a couple months, and it is something that, we need special attention. I think part of it is just making sure that, I mean, even if it's me or members of our team, that we attend local meetings more and see how we can remove some of those roadblocks. Because, I mean, yeah, it's not fair to citizens that this keeps happening. And, it's an item that I definitely want to pay special attention to. And make sure that it gets done. And there's honestly, infrastructure funding, like I brought up before, is a huge problem in the district. I mean, we even see in Springfield, there's historically a lot of segregation in Springfield. And those are things too that I really want to make sure that we invest in all parts of the community. And if that means pressuring local leaders, then so be it.
What do you make of the district and its physical makeup, right? Starts in Urbana-Champaign, where you live,
yeah,
over to Springfield, down to a majority of the Metro East. Is it kind of a weird thing to get into this race in such a strangely shaped district, thanks to Democratic gerrymandering?
It is a little strange, and it is hard too. Like I said, I live in Urbana, so it's a 3-hour drive just to get to the other side of the district. But ultimately, I think one of the things that I joke with too is we have a ton of volunteers throughout the district, but especially in Champaign-Urbana. And I do always tell them, hey, Champaign-Urbana problems are not always District 13 problems, because historically throughout Metro East, Decatur, Springfield, like I said, we have tons of businesses that have left. Like, we just have hardworking people that now don't have the same jobs that they did before. But at the same point, like, Champaign-Urbana is very progressive. They also have a lot of issues with their unions have lost collective bargaining power over the years. And so I think that is kind of the trend that unites us is, hey, like, we're beautiful Central Illinois, and we really just need to fight for workers.
Closing message, what should voters out there know about you, or maybe better yet, why should they pick you over Congresswoman Budzinski?
A couple months ago, somebody asked me, why are you running for Congress? And I immediately said, well, I just want to help people. And so I just want people to know that I am not doing this for myself or personal gain. I just want to help people. And that's why I've worked in healthcare. I was a combat medic and medical planner in the military. I actually got into med school at one point, and I decided not to go. But I've always wanted to help people. And so that's really just the main thing is moving forward. I want you to know that I will always fight for you. That's why I'm a grassroots candidate. That's why I don't take money from corporations or foreign interest groups. I want to fight for the people. And so I'm just happy to do it. And thank you, everyone, for listening today. If you want to check out more, you can visit my website at dylanforillinois.com. I'm also on Instagram at Dylan Blahoff for Congress. But thank you very much.
Yeah, no, thank you for coming in, Dylan, and for making the 3-hour drive over here.
No, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
If you haven't listened, we did an interview with Dylan's primary opponent, Nikki Budzinski, which should be in the same feed that you're listening to this podcast. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, a listener-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis. Until next time, so long.